From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a Michigan tribal chair reacts to the possibility of Native leadership in President Biden's cabinet.
Oftentimes, federal agencies take the easy path, which is sometimes not in the best interest of tribes.
And the new chief for Michigan's Health and Human Services talks about the next pandemic battlegrounds.
If things continue to stay trending the way that they are, and our vaccination rates continue to increase, we can look forward to seeing some expansions in the orders that are coming in the future.
Also on the show, rediscovering Idlewild, where generations of Black Michiganders went for vacation and respite.
Idlewild was forged during a time of segregation. You know, I think the need for spaces that are authentically safe for Black folks is as important now as it was then.
All that and more coming up this hour. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on the program, we'll be talking with the new head of Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services. It's a conversation with Elizabeth Hertel later in the show. But first, today, Congresswoman Deb Haaland begins Senate confirmation hearings as President Biden's pick to head the U.S. Department of the Interior. She is the first Native American nominated to lead a cabinet-level department in American history. Given the Interior Department's history of mistreating Native people and the many intersections its work has with Native nations today, her nomination is huge news. Here to talk about the relationships between the U.S. government and tribes is Aaron Payment. He's chair of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. He also serves as vice president for the National Congress of American Indians. Aaron, welcome back to Stateside.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
What are some top priorities that you'd like to see the Biden administration address in the next year?
Well, first of all, I think we're getting off on a really good start with the Biden-Harris administration issued a presidential memorandum that reinforced consultation, true consultation, government to government with tribes, and set some real strict timelines for when that will have to be done. Some of the main issues, I would say, would be full funding for the treaty and trust responsibility. We say that we prepaid with the 500 million acres of land in promise for health, education, and social welfare into perpetuity. And then that leads us to advanced appropriations. We should not have to worry during sequestration or government shutdowns about getting our funding. Advanced appropriations would appropriate the money 1 year in advance. And then our funding should be mandatory. And just as we can't really evict people, everybody that came here, the federal government should be on the hook to fulfill the treaty and trust responsibility funding. The Supreme Court a number of years ago had a ruling that called into question the land and trust process for tribes. The administration should streamline the land and trust process because we were once at a time where we didn't have any political capital or resources to fight for to protect our natural resources or our land. We're in a different position, and so as tribes rebuild, we need land in order to do that, so the process should be streamlined for tribes. So those are some of the top line issues. As an education leader, I have my doctorate in education, always pushing for additional attention to, we have the worst graduation rate out of any racial ethnic population. 93% of our people go to public schools. So focusing on education and addressing that, education is one of those treaty and trust responsibilities that we prepaid. So that's another really big one.
The memorandum that you mentioned that President Biden signed last month on tribal consultation, what kind of significance does that hold at home for the Sioux tribe? Are there any issues that kind of consultation might make a difference in?
Oh, yeah. So there's ebbs and flows with federal policy, and, you know, we're inching forward. The first consultation policy was by executive order by President Clinton, and then advanced by President Obama, and President Biden took it a step further with some timelines for when it needs to be done. Mainly the reason is because when the federal government, in its paternalistic way, and that's the tradition of America, will make decisions and basically tell tribes after the fact. And so we're actually pushing for prior consent. And so that we need to be engaged in any legislation or any administration implementation that affects tribes. So it will make all the difference in the world, because oftentimes federal agencies and bureaucracies take the most direct path and the easy path, which is sometimes not in the best interest of tribes. So this way our voices will be strongly heard and we'll be able to effectuate policy before it happens.
So it's not so much an issue of it's not so much one issue or another, but an overall question of how the process works on all negotiations.
Yes, absolutely.
Representative Deb Haaland's confirmation hearings as Secretary of Interior are a historic mark in terms of the U.S. government. Assuming she's confirmed, do you think she has the opportunity to make some real change that would affect the Sioux Tribe and other nations?
I do. First of all, you know, I've read a lot of the back and forth and comments from some senators who call into question her qualifications, and I find that to be very paternalistic and a little misogynistic. Deborah Haaland served as a tribal administrator, so somebody who knows what that is, what that means. Tribal administrators have to understand state, local, and federal laws, regulations, and policies, and be adept at applying for federal grants and know how to manage those grants and be subject to audits. And so that experience transcends most of what the executive level appointments in any presidential administration have. And she has that experience. And she also, in the very brief time that she's been a member of Congress, she's played a very strong leadership role in a bipartisan way. And she's been able to pull together disparate opinions and to come together. And so she has demonstrated her ability to interface at the legislative level, at the executive level, the administrative level. And so she's very well qualified. And so what that means for Indian Country is, for once, we will have a voice like ours and somebody who looks like us that will be at the cabinet level. It's historic because we have never had a Native American nominee at the cabinet level. And when you think about that for a second, that's really a tragedy in and of itself, because, you know, we're going on 260 or more years as a country, and we've never saw fit to see the talent that is right in front of us. And so Indian Country is celebrating her nomination, and we are resolute to support her nomination. And we're looking to those senators very closely that don't support her, because it doesn't seem possible that you as a senator can support Indian Country and not support the first nominee from Indian Country to serve at the highest level.
Aaron, there are other cabinet appointments awaiting us that have the potential to mean some different things for tribal nations. The Indian Health Service has been so seriously underfunded for so many years. Would you expect that to change if Dr. Rachel Levine is confirmed as the head of the Department of Health and Human Services?
So we have under HHS, we have a Secretary Tribal Advisory Council, of which I serve on. And through the different administrations, we've been able to effectively advocate tribal leaders from across the country. And so I believe, especially under this administration, that any nominee that is appointed is going to take the direction from the president and is going to do proper outreach to tribes. What we talked earlier about consultation, so rather than making decisions for us, these decisions will involve us. And so I'm looking forward to whoever ends up being, our chain up to the president. And for the IHS director, I was vetted at one point, and I chose to prioritize my tribal role. I think I have a much louder voice as a tribal leader. But whoever ends up being the IHS director, we do hope it's an American Indian. But whoever it is, we will make it work.
Yeah. We've said several times over the past 14 months that the COVID-19 pandemic has exposed the very serious fractures in how the United States treats almost all Americans' health, but certainly also people of color. And we know that Native people have been getting sick and have been lost to COVID at several times the rate of other Americans. What's needed right now to triage the situation that you see?
Yes, so I'm glad you asked me that question. The rate of death is 2.5 times for American Indians as it is for the general population. And when we talk about that statistic is it's probably not as accurate a statistic, and we believe it's worse. And the reason for that is because the data that is collected for tribes is through Indian Health Service. Indian Health Service serves a limited population on or near reservations. So for my tribe, one-third of our people live on or near our reservation in what's called our purchase and referred service area, but two-thirds of my members do not. And so just to give you some examples of numbers, we have inoculated over 4,000 people so far. We've been pretty successful in that, but that's 4,000 out of 16,500 in that service area. We have 45,000 members. So 4,000 out of 45,000 is not significant. It's not the kind of headway we should be making. And that's in large part because of the way Health Service, through the Indian Health Services and the federal government, is reaching out to fulfill that treaty and trust responsibility by unfortunately ignoring the largest populations of our tribes, which live away from that service area. And so the need is dire. We believe we have the highest risk. If you look at the Broken Promises report that was published in 2018 by the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, it demonstrates we have the worst of the worst statistics, including heart disease, diabetes, cancer. And so we have the highest risk factors to begin with. Then add to it the rural nature of where our people live, and if they don't live near an IHS health delivery system, those are the people that are most, they're the worst of the worst statistics and the most people that are at risk. And so unfortunately, we are just not reaching them right now. There is no appropriations to reach out to that population. They have to line up like anybody else, any other citizen in the state. And that might not seem unfair because everybody else has got to line up, but tribes have prepaid for our healthcare delivery system, and so two-thirds of my population are left out.
Aaron, I think there's a lot of other, there are many other issues we could talk about, but I know your time is tight. Is there anything else we didn't discuss that you think is important for people to keep in mind right now?
Yeah, it's just that with the consultation policy that the president put out, tribal nations are urged to take the time. You know, we can get jaded because in the past we've been asked our opinion before, and in the past it has been ignored, but we believe this is different. We believe we're moving into a new era. And so tribal leaders all across the country need to pay close attention to those notices, and they need to get on those calls. Because if you don't exercise your voice, you abandon your ancestors and your future generations. And if we're not speaking up, people won't hear us.
Aaron Payment is chairperson of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. He's also the vice president of the National Congress of American Indians. Aaron, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Up next, Idlewild, Michigan, and its future in leisure and tourism. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we're continuing a conversation about the history and future of Black spaces in Michigan. And we're taking it up north to a more rural context, to a place known as the Black Eden of Michigan. Over the past 100 years, Idlewild has been many things, an entertainment and resort space for the who's who of Black celebrity, a peaceful haven when Jim Crow and segregation made safety feel impossible for Black people. And these days, there's a renewed interest in this part of Yates Township, where Black families still live and new energy's budding. With us today are the creators of Experience Idlewild, which promotes and supports people as they plan their return, whether short or long term. Blair Evans is a member of the Yates Township Planning Commission. And also with us is Susan Matus, a property management and tourism entrepreneur. Susan, Blair, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What brought you to Idlewild?
Well, my grandparents started coming up here in the 20s. So I have been coming up here all my life. Old family story. I was born in July. My mother was up here in June. So I guess I could say I've been coming up here since before I was born. Yeah. So it's just been a part of my flow.
And then Blair and I, well, Blair brought me up here close to 15 years ago, and I fell in love with the place. And originally we were just coming up. I was just coming up here as part of our vacation getaway. And then in the last couple years, we transitioned more into the business side of it. And now we're full-time residents.
What do you love about this community?
That's a deep question. Mm-hmm. I think you know, for me, obviously it brings back, you know, lifelong memories. But I think the reason that it resonates so much is because, one, it's a beautiful place, unspoiled natural resources, clean air, clean water, great recreation, those kind of things. It's got a culture that's unapologetically Black, which is rare to find. And it's got a history of self-determination and community building, which I think is very important, not just for the past arc, but to point towards what we need to be doing in the future also.
Yeah. I guess like you could say I'm an outdoorsy person, so I really enjoy having access to the lake and the forest. It's all very healing and rejuvenating to be, you know, here in this little oasis. And born and raised in the city of Detroit. So when I came up here, you know, I knew a few of the people that were here, though I didn't grow up coming here. And, you know, just this tight-knit community. Love being able to know my neighbors and work with amazing people that want to come up and be a part of Idyllwild's continued legacy, really.
What was the impetus for starting your work with Experience Idyllwild?
I think Susan will probably speak to that deeply, but a lot of it was just an opportunity for the people who are up here to have a way to speak their own truth about Idyllwild. There's a lot of ancient narrative out there about rise and fall, abandonment, whatever. And the reality of Idyllwild as we've experienced it, and as many people up here are experiencing it, is that one, it never went away. And two, there's a significant kind of reinvention based on basic principles of young people, given the current generations and looking forward to their children and the like. So it was an opportunity to expose people to what is really going on to Idyllwild and to give people an opportunity to understand the cultural events, the recreational events that could give them a taste of what's happening. And we have noticed that once people kind of experience Idyllwild, mm-hmm. It's very impactful.
Mm-hmm. Like I mentioned before, it was our vacation getaway from the city. And then one summer, some folks mentioned to us about this Morton's Motel business that needed help. And just one summer it was, oh, we have a motel and I'm now running it. So we kind of made that work and made that happen quickly. And then once we got our feet wet with that, we saw a need for other ways we could contribute to the community. And after a while, it was just what we had to do. You know, the old saying, if not us, then who? So an Experience Idyllwild, we did craft that. We had help from Blair's niece, Nikki Studstill, and she kind of helped us coin that term because we did find once people got up here, most people, they fell in love with Idyllwild and wanted to come back and see and keep participating. And then so we just kind of spun that off from, you know, a catchphrase to our Facebook page and Instagram and then our website. So then it was out there. It was more visible, not just about the, you know, Idyllwild's heyday, but yes, there are people still here, you know, bringing their families back time and time again and enjoying Idyllwild.
And there's a whole new heyday that's evolving.
Yes.
And again, it's people, the young folks are creating it in a way that makes sense for them, mm-hmm. which is the way it should happen.
Right. What are you learning about life there as you started to set yourself up?
Well, I think for me, I mean, it was certainly eyes wide open. You know, I was quite familiar with the ins and outs and the goings on. We had kind of gotten to the point where you're here half the year anyway. And most of the interesting things, the interesting people, the most fascinating projects and the like were really centered more around the Idyllwild area than they were any other things that we were doing. And we were doing some pretty interesting other things too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely a privilege and an honor to do this work. But on a practical level, he, you know, even though he came up all his life, so he kind of knew the ins and outs. I, you know, even though I love nature, I was a city girl. So, you know, you have to learn some of the, you know, ways of adjusting to, you know, driving half an hour to go to the grocery store or fixing plumbing or air conditionings when they go out. All those, you know, fun things. But, you know, that's just because we're pretty hands-on. But there are other people that we work with who are invaluable in our community that help us out and are supporting not only us, but the greater goal.
Right. You know, there's this narrative that we all know of Idlewild as a paradise and a really vibrant and dynamic kind of place. People hear stories about Louis Armstrong and Aretha Franklin and B.B. King coming there as performers. Are you setting out with this effort with the idea of, you know, a kind of restoration or about thinking about what kind of space Idlewild can and should be in the future?
Good question.
Yes. So, you know, it's a matter of kind of what level of abstraction you're thinking in. You know, Idlewild, you know, was forged during a time of segregation. And so in those circumstances, you know, those ideas of, you know, a safe space for mental health reasons and, you know, a place to build community wealth and a place to exercise self-determination and to allow people to really kind of manifest themselves amongst other people who respect them as first-class citizens was something that was very important in Idlewild. And Idlewild was, you know, really built nuts and bolts by the Black folks who inhabited Idlewild. You know, I think the need for spaces that are authentically safe for Black folks is as important now as it was then. The need for folks to kind of understand how to fully participate in all of the avenues of township, civic life. You know, you can get lost in larger places and feel like you're always just battered by things that are out of your control. You know, in this space, you can actually kind of wrap your arms around things that are going on and understand, you know, what your value is and how you can contribute in unique ways in the community. And so, you know, I think we're trying to restore the purpose of Idlewild, mm-hmm. but the circumstances in, you know, 2020 are different than they were in 1920. And so we're reinstantiating the same principles with respect for the fact that, you know, the circumstances have changed, but the importance of the place hasn't.
Are there ways that those ideas influence the work that you're trying to do?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the work that we do is kind of platform and enabling work. Mm-hmm. You know, we've worked on providing infrastructure so that people who want to do things have an ability to do it. You know, part of it is, you know, kind of understanding that the whole community kind of creates a place. But another major part of it is as you start looking at how this evolves, you know, you start dealing with those issues of what is community and what is wealth creation. You know, how do you democratize the ways for people to participate and create value for themselves? Mm-hmm. You know, even though they may not be rich in capital, mm-hmm. they may be rich in those things that people find value in. And how do you create the kind of experience in the arts and culture, but also in the economics and in institutional structures where people can benefit from the contributions that they make? So, you know, if the community is vibrant and wealthy overall, everybody doesn't have to try to create their own little isolated, I've got everything I need. Mm-hmm. I can rely on the community. I need enough for me, but the value is in the interaction with other people and in the value of the community that we're creating.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Blair Evans and Susan Matus. They co-founded Experience Idlewild, and they've been active in different ways to build on the legacy of Idlewild as a safe recreational destination for Black Americans from Michigan and beyond. As a practical matter, what are some of the barriers that you're trying to break down and some of the things that you're trying to make possible? Say someone wants to, you know, start an Airbnb or, you know, like a small resort there. What are the tools that you're trying to build for them?
Well, you know, one, joining the Planning Commission is to have kind of a coherent master plan that actually respects the unique qualities of Idlewild and Yates Township. I mean, some of it is, you know, lodging, a restaurant, and food services. I mean, you got events, you have a major load, and then you have other times there's a minimal load. That's kind of difficult for folks to manage in terms of the gaps and the spikes in that. So helping people kind of develop a calendar so there's a normal rhythm. Right. It can be as simple as that. But also, many, many folks are doing events, and events have common needs. You know, security is a need. Emergency management and coordination is a need. Everybody doesn't have to reinvent a way of doing that if we're all using the same space, right? So if we all invest in coming up with some common ways of making that happen, it's less expensive and more effective for everybody to kind of do it that way. So, you know, a lot of folks have an idea to swing for the fences when they come up for their first event. And we generally kind of talk to folks about, you know, doing a a small version first so that you can know what's here and what's not and what you do and don't know. Right. And then after you kind of figure out, you know, I can't run down the street and do this, mm-hmm. You know, as I would in Grand Rapids or as I would in Detroit, then, you know, here's the stack of things that it takes to make this happen. Here's a part of that that is really my expertise as an event coordinator. Here's the part that I need to do just because it needs to be done. And if we can analyze the similarities of that, then one of the other entrepreneurs may want to take that as a service to provide to everybody. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of thing.
What are some kinds of programming that you've worked on at Idlewild over the years?
I mean, we've been involved with a lot of people's programming. You know, we've done some specific things like bringing the Smithsonian documentary on the Green Book here, because Idlewild was featured in that, you know, as a showing. We've had community conversations about the history of Idlewild, et cetera. But we support and provide infrastructure to a lot of the people who are doing music festivals and film festivals and spoken word festivals and recreational activities and, you know, biking activities and lake activities, et cetera. Yeah, there's a whole network of entrepreneurs who are doing things, which we're happy to help them be successful.
We're in a position right now where a lot of Michigan's, shall we say, water-adjacent real estate is going through a period of pretty high demand right now. As you think about Idlewild's future and what you're both trying to build, are there concerns or considerations that you have about how growth happens and how building happens that will support the kind of safe community that you're talking about?
Well, yeah, they're certainly not making any more lakefront property. That's, you know, the old saying. And, I mean, property prices in Idlewild have gone up significantly just over the last 3 or 4 years. A lot of that is due to the resurgence of a lot of the events and the like that are going on. People come up, get interested in the place, and are buying and are putting pressure on the property values. But we're also trying to create the opportunity to have high-value property that's not just necessarily the limited amount that's on the lake, mm-hmm. and to provide ways of cooperatively owning and utilizing the property that is on the lake. You know, a lot of lakefront property, people may use it 2 or 3 weeks out of the year if they own it individually. But there are ways of multiple people collaborating on the same piece of property. You know, we helped start an artist collaborative up here on one of the lakes. And so they collectively kind of purchase property, and they're organizing their programming and utilizing the space to timeshare it in reasonable ways. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you may have 6 or 7 people who then have the same value they would have gotten out of one place, you know, individually, without all the headache of trying to manage the place by themselves. And so that gets back to kind of cooperative and collaborative work and democratizing access to things in different ways.
And we work with the Lake Association as well as the Lot Owners Association here in Idlewild. And because as people are reengaging and more people are coming up, we do want people to be educated and respectful of not only the Idlewild community and its history, but the land and the water too.
Obviously, just about all vacation areas are going through huge demand right now because of COVID, and people have been just desperate to get away and to get a break from daily life. What kinds of things are you telling people who have questions now about coming to Idlewild this summer?
Well, I guess we could start with last summer. Mm-hmm. You know, we were very cautious and conservative. You know, Idlewild is a community that has a lot of, the people have a lot of risk factors. We don't have a huge healthcare infrastructure. We have an aging population that's the year-round population. Mm-hmm. The usual range of comorbidities. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we were very cautious about having a lot of traffic come into the community during times where we didn't know what the arc of the pandemic was going to look like. And I'm glad we did, because the arc of the pandemic did not look good. Mm-hmm. This year, it's still, you know, unclear. There's a race, you know, between certain interventions and, you know, variants and mutations and that kind of thing. You know, we have been, you know, talking to people about longer term stays. You know, week to week, as opposed to quick kind of in and outs, mm-hmm. to, you know, allow people to kind of come and appreciate the lakefront cottage or that kind of thing, but not in the same way that they'd be out and about in the community when the community is vulnerable to some of the impacts of the pandemic. So I'd say 2021 is probably going to start ramping up a little bit, mm-hmm. You know, 2020 basically had a full calendar from late June through September, every weekend.
Yeah.
Everybody who was on that schedule is still very intent on doing projects in the future.
Yes.
They're waiting. basically all of them individually decided that they didn't want to expose the community mm-hmm. to risk from their events. And so we're just having conversations with everybody now about how 2021 is going to go. And I don't think everybody knows specifically, but I think folks are tentatively planning on outdoor, socially distanced type events that may be feasible this summer for 2021.
Yes, we've gotten quite a few requests from people to, you know, for booking their vacation stays to the event directors, you know, and everybody's cautious and just trying to, you know, just kind of wait it out to see what's the best way to make it happen safely here in Idyllwild again.
Susan Matus and Blair Evans are the creative forces behind Experience Idyllwild. Blair is a member of the Yates County Planning Commission, and Susan is a property management and tourism entrepreneur, and they both live there. Blair, Susan, it's been great talking to you. You guys stay safe up there, and we're wishing you all the best for spring and summer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate you guys reaching out to us.
In just a moment, we meet one of the business casualties of the pandemic. A comic book shop up north is closing its doors. Stay with us for that story and more. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The COVID-19 pandemic has financially crippled many small businesses, including specialty shops. That meant one beloved comic book store in Cadillac had to recently close its doors. With it closed a community stronghold. Interlochen Public Radio's Taylor Wisner reports.
To those who spent a lot of time there, Comic Book ER was much more than a simple comic shop. It was where Cadillac's outsiders and geeks came together, a space where they were safe to be themselves, regardless of gender identity or religion, says store owner Rob Grimes.
Very often people would come there and express all sorts of opinions, but not fear judgment and not fear harassment.
Rob says a veteran volunteered there as he started to rejoin civilian life, and a local priest started a group that met monthly at the shop called Comic Chat, a sort of book club where people could try out ideas.
It almost seemed like a mini church.
The store put on a new event each month, giving away free comic books, holding Star Wars movie nights, and even bringing in a big-name anime voice artist. There was a nonprofit connected to the store. The trustees were striving to tackle some community issues, like improving literacy and creating connections with LGBTQ groups. Beverly Hall, who volunteered at Comic Book ER for several years, says she watched as the store became a haven for young people.
It's a very conservative community. A lot of kids, if they come out, it means homelessness for some of them. There aren't a lot of places of refuge for them.
Beverly herself found solace at the store. She worked full-time as an insurance agent, but spent weekends looking at comics. An Asian woman in her 50s, Beverly's not necessarily the image of a comic book consumer painted by popular culture. But she says Comic Book ER welcomed her. Growing up in a strict Baptist home in Irons, Michigan, a small town 30 miles east of Manistee, one of the only forms of pop culture Beverly consumed was Star Trek reruns.
My fandoms go back a long, long way.
She got really into comics, but she drifted away as she raised her family. It was after her 14-year-old son died from epilepsy a few years ago that she found herself spending a lot of time at the store.
The community was important. The escape was important.
Beverly loved being in a space where she could geek out with other fans, something she says feels even more important during COVID. Places like Comic Book ER are rare in small to medium-sized towns because there often isn't a lot of institutional support, says owner Rob Grimes. But he says the store was doing well before the pandemic and had reached its stride a few years into operating. When COVID hit and the store closed, the building's owner cut him some slack on the rent, while the comic book distributors stopped sending new product. Still, it was hard to turn a profit.
We were really committed to saying, you know, we can get through this and we can get through this together.
Rob tried everything he could. He did mail-in orders, made his store safe when he could reopen, but it didn't make a difference.
Slowly but surely, I kept seeing the books, and sales were down. There was just nothing you could do about it. Costs were up.
And there was another issue. Some of his customers were hostile to the mask mandate. They'd hurl insults at Rob and threatened to boycott the store. He says that was the final straw, They couldn't keep fighting each day to keep the store open when a vocal minority made his dream business so unpleasant.
I had worked all these years to promote the idea of community and supporting each other and being there for your neighbor, which I always felt superheroes promoted. And then not see it come back and actually see it come back with some venom.
He has other projects on the line, but he's wary about what to get involved in. One day, Rob says he'd love to help someone else bring comics back to Cadillac. I'm Taylor Wisner.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Elizabeth Hertel took the helm at Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services at a very difficult time during the pandemic.
I'm really excited to be in this position and to be leading this department. I think that we have a great staff. Our employees are wonderful. They've done a great job in responding to the pandemic, and we continue to make progress every day.
Sure, health officials are getting vaccines in arms at this point, but there are still problems with death tolls and infection rates. And the damage that COVID has done to our state's economy continues to spark bruising political battles over the restrictions that are needed to protect people. Elizabeth Hertel joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Let's begin with what's going on in Michigan's bars and restaurants. The Department of Health and Human Services has allowed these businesses to reopen with a limited indoor capacity that started on February 1. And that order is set to expire this coming Sunday, February 21st. The order on limited dining room capacity has been extended until March 29th. Can you tell us about that decision?
The extension of that order was a result of us amending the order to allow for competition in contact sports, to give those athletic teams time to schedule out their winter seasons. We continue to look at the data on case rates and positivity for COVID-19 and are going over the restrictions that are in place daily, looking hopefully to be making changes prior to the expiration of the current order on the 29th.
What's the connection between the contact sports order and restaurants and bars?
All of those elements are in the same order of gatherings. And so when we amended that order for contact sports, it changed the entire order. It's not an order separate from the gatherings order. So that's why.
The coronavirus metrics are looking a little bit better at the time we're having this conversation. But of course, everyone's concerned about the fact that the variant B.1.1.7 is still spreading. How do you recommend we think about protecting the public from this? I mean, are stronger methods appropriate for a more aggressive spreader, or is it just a case of staying the course with what we're already doing?
That's a really good question. I think it's important to stay the course with what we're already doing. I think the case rates declining and the numbers looking better is evidence that people are still working very hard to maintain those mitigation efforts. We continue to watch the numbers of the B.1.1.7 variant where they are identified, and we'll continue to track those as we move forward. We do want to continue to be cautious as we begin to reengage more actively sectors of the economy. But if things continue to stay trending the way that they are, and our vaccination rates continue to increase as we anticipate they will, I think that we can look forward to seeing some expansions in the orders that are coming in the future.
Let's take a minute to talk about the budget proposal for MDHHS for fiscal year 2022. The department's recommendations include $31.5 billion in ongoing department funding, $5.2 million from the state's general fund, and more than 70% of the funds given to the department will come from the federal government. One of the priorities in the proposal is money for behavioral and mental health. Why was this a priority?
Our focus has been and will stay on expanded access for behavioral health services moving forward. especially considering the light, I think, that was shown on the issue through the pandemic and increased isolation and its effects on people either, you know, developing mental health issues or exacerbating existing issues. So we are able to start piloting a new model beginning in the fall, hopefully through community-based health centers that will create a medical home that has a behavioral health component in it. And then a large chunk of the funding will be dedicated to looking at how we are providing services for children across the state, including those kids in foster care.
Would you say that the amount proposed in the budget meets the need right now?
I don't know. I'm not sure. But I think it's a really good start. Anything that we can do that expands these services is going to be you know, a change from where we are today, and all progress is good progress.
One of the big issues right now for healthcare providers across the country, and certainly in Michigan, is staffing. There are burnout issues in our hospitals and clinics. Pay rates are not where they should be from the perspective of people doing these jobs. And now, of course, all the issues we see in COVID. What's in the budget that would help address that?
We are able to have in the governor's executive recommendation a proposal to increase wages for direct care workers. So that would cover in-home help and behavioral health services by $2 an hour, which is something that is a priority for our department and this administration to ensure that people who are helping to care for some of our most vulnerable citizens are making wages that they can sustain themselves and their families on.
Mm-hmm. The pandemic has also hit the nursing home community particularly hard, both people who live in assisted living and nursing homes and those who work there. There's a part of the budget proposal called Michigan Choice that allows elders to live at home receiving the same kind of care they can receive in a nursing home. It's going to get some expanded funding. So this program already existed, correct?
Yes, this program has been in place for a number of years. We are able, in partnership with the federal government through our Medicaid funding for those who are nursing home eligible, able to divert some of that funding so that we can provide supports for people who may need to go into a nursing home to have those supports provided in their homes. So this recommendation would allow us to expand the number of people that we could support staying in their home instead of getting being admitted into a nursing home.
We talk about the fact that the pandemic exposed the fault lines in the healthcare system. Do you think that there are certain uncomfortable truths about congregate care that the pandemic has pointed out that we need to address?
I think one of the things that this pandemic has really illustrated is the importance of the people on whom we rely to help care for the individuals who are living in congregate care facilities or who are living in their homes and receiving in-home help, and really demonstrating that we should be investing resources in that workforce so that we can ensure that those individuals stay safe and are cared for in an appropriate way.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the vaccines that the Department of Health and Human Services has had a role in distributing all throughout Michigan. We've talked at length with Dr. Jonah Khaldun, the state's chief medical executive, about this. And we know that the state has started to look at vaccination dispersal through an equity lens, really making sure that yes, things get out efficiently, but also they get out to people who are at the greatest risk. We're in a situation right now where there's been some pushback to if not overtly to the way the state is doing this, to just the concepts. The Livingston County Board of Commissioners has unanimously approved a resolution calling on the state health department and Governor Whitmer to replace this plan. Do you have any comment on that?
I think it's really important as we work to get to a post-pandemic environment that we take the lessons that were there as we went through the pandemic and our response. And what we saw with COVID-19 was that it did reach certain populations more than it did others. They're certainly disproportionate among more vulnerable populations, among residents of color, among the elderly, as you mentioned, those in congregate care. And we saw significantly more severe outcomes with those populations. So as we work to distribute the vaccine across the state, it makes sense to use the general population as a baseline, and then to also be able to focus on those vulnerable populations to ensure that we're balancing that disproportionality out. So I think it's really important that we do try to minimize harm that could still come to those populations that are more vulnerable, which is why we started with, you know, nursing home residents and vaccinations, because we know that's a population that was significantly more vulnerable to the transmission and severe outcomes from COVID-19. So I think as we continue down this course, we will continue to explore strategies to ensure that we're meeting these populations who we have seen very clearly are more vulnerable to COVID-19.
The framing of this issue in the discussion was suggesting that elderly people in Livingston County, who are by and large white seniors, are somehow getting left behind. Is there any merit to that criticism?
When we look at our state allocation methodology, we use the population base 65 and older in each county as our baseline. And we do an initial distribution on that population. Some areas do receive more weighting because of where they fall on the vulnerability index, but we do have a baseline to distribute the vaccine based on population density.
MDHHS is responsible for the whole of the epidemic response. Are there things that this process has taught you about how prepared we are, or about just how we ought to tackle public health differently in the years to come?
When we went through as a state the recession in the 2000 to 2010, one of the areas that we saw a significant reduction in funding for investment was in our public health infrastructure and our information technology infrastructure. And that became very apparent as we began our response to COVID-19, that the information technology that we use to support public health was outdated, and that we need to ensure that we have appropriate staffing and expertise when it comes to being prepared to respond to public health emergencies. So I think if anything, hopefully this has demonstrated the importance of maintaining investment in public health, because with public health, we don't know how important it is until something happens, until there is an emergency, because the role of public health is to keep us safe and happy. And when it's working, we don't really realize that it's there. It's when we see something like this pandemic unfold that we really recognize the importance of having that public health infrastructure in place and having it appropriately funded.
When do you think is the time to tackle those issues? Is it something that we deal with now, bandwidth or not, or can it wait until the recovery?
Absolutely, we should start tackling those issues now. We have been, at the state level, have received significant amount of federal funding last year to help support those efforts. And we also have received from the federal government in January, large amounts of money to help us continue to support those public health infrastructure. Unfortunately, at this point, that funding has not been appropriated by the legislature. And so our ability to continue propping that infrastructure up and making improvements is limited until we are able to access the funding. And that won't occur until the legislature can appropriate it for us.
Elizabeth Hertel is the director of Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services. Thanks for taking some time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. Stateside is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Bear. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.